Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Elliot Perlman, who reads from and discusses his new book, The Reasons I Won't Be Coming, published by Riverhead. In the weeks to come, we have Joseph Ellis, Linda Fairstein, Dave Barry, Julian Barnes, Jill Connor Brown, John Hodgman, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. Welcome to the Tattered Cover, and thank you so much for supporting our events, and thank you for supporting independent bookstores. And if I could just ask you to silence your cell phones for the next little while, that would be great. Tonight, it's my pleasure to introduce author Elliot Perlman, who will discuss his new collection of short stories, The Reasons I Won't Be Coming. This New York Times notable book includes 9 stories exploring lives of lovers, lawyers, students, murderers, and immigrants. Short stories allow readers to see bits of people's lives, and yet it's enough of a bite of their life that we really get a sense of them and their place. They're very interesting nuggets of information that I always tell my book clubs are excellent sources of discussion and material. And sometimes we can even relate to those people. The Reasons I Won't Be Coming also won the Australia's Steel Rudd Award. Elliot Perlman is from Melbourne, Australia, where he worked as a barrister. It is our good fortune that he decided to change careers and become a writer. He's been described as the foremost voice of the new generation of Australian writers. The New York Times praised Elliot Perlman as demonstrating traces of Dickens' range and George Eliot's generous human spirit. Elliot's other award-winning books are 7 Types of Ambiguity, new out in paperback, and $3. Please welcome Elliot Perlman.
Thank you. I hope I can be heard. Thanks so much for that generous introduction. There's one tiny thing I should correct just for the sake of accuracy. It was actually 7 Types of Ambiguity that was the Times, New York Times Notable Book of the Year. But, you know, from your mouth to God's ear for the reasons I won't be coming. But, I mean, there is a tendency to feel that you need to defend short stories because they're like the poor little brother or sister of the novel. And, you know, sometimes you even have to explain why it is you write them. And, okay, so I'll explain briefly why it is I write them. I write them because I like to read them. And it might sound a little bit of a pat answer, but I'm sure essentially this is true for nearly all writers. But I think what we're really trying to do is write something that we would want to read. I mean, you will at times hear people say that they wrote something that they felt was particularly commercial to try and make a lot of money. And they might, you know, that might sound cynical, but they're doing it to buy time to write what they really want to write, or else they're doing it to buy a condo or something, or pay for their drug habit or something. But I find it hard enough to write something I'd want to read, so I only write things I would want to read. And when I find that I finished it and I don't want to read it, I don't submit it to the public. So you can rest assured that there was at least one time when I wanted to read everything that that I finally let escape. What I thought I would do is read you one short story from The Reasons I Won't Be Coming, and then, depending on the time and other factors that I can't begin to mention right now, I might read very briefly from 7 Types of Ambiguity. So the story I thought I would start with is called Good Morning Again, and it's the first story in The Reasons I Won't Be Coming. So here is Good Morning Again. Her sinuses are blocked and she doesn't know. She would be embarrassed if she did. I shouldn't know either. At 4 o'clock in the morning, with a new friend asleep beside me, I remember standing in the rain that night, feeling angrily disconnected, as you cried with incomprehensible frustration at my failure to agree that group therapy was just as likely to be of benefit to someone unnamed, as private sessions. We'd just eaten Thai food. It had been a good day in spite of the rain, towards the end. At 4 o'clock in the morning, I haven't slept at all. But when she wakes up, I will have to continue the date as though I had slept, part lover, part waiter, part Tonight Show host. After sheltering from the rain for a little while, sharp and brittle, apart, I could tell that you were going to cry, but you were not sad, not yet. You were frustrated, and I was equally frustrated. It's just that I don't cry at those times. What time is it now? Way past 4. She sprawls diagonally in bed, leaning towards me, assuming an inequitable familiarity. As tempting as it is to mistake this for an accelerated form of love, I quickly attribute it to her youth, her previous experience or lack of it, her urgent need for more experience. She is the young friend of a friend, my new friend, and I will learn soon that neither she nor I really need any rude awakenings at the moment. The neighbours have started making a racket again. They never care what time it is. They sell antique furniture not far from here, and he gets up early every weekend to make it. His wife takes their young son into the garden, where they can perfect his tantrums without the artificial restriction of walls. My new friend won't be able to sleep through all of this. You never could. Why was it so important to either of us? You were trying to tell me something, and I was trying to tell you something else. We didn't trust each other, and that was reason enough to make each of us right. You thought I was too rigid. I thought you were too open, prone to putting your faith in something just because you wanted to, even when you'd been shown it contained some logical flaws. But you are intelligent, and the contradictions hurt you as much as the fact that it was me pointing them out. Your eyes became red. I should have hugged you then in that rain, but I was never one for public displays of affection, was I? Except in comparison to you, that is. I discovered this when we met. It had been such a long time since I had met someone who didn't care what my star sign was. "Good morning," my new friend says with one eye open. "How did you sleep?" I ask. "Great," she says, putting her hand gently to my forehead. She's breathing through her mouth now. "Did they wake you?" I ask, indicating next door. There is a throbbing in my head. "Something did, I suppose. What is that noise?" "It's just a local amalgam of irritating sounds. There's a hammer, a sander, of course, and a circular saw. He's building some really delightful Victorian pieces. They'll be ready by noon." "And that shrill hysteria which occasionally approximates language? That's his wife and their new gargantuan son. It was bad enough before he was born, but now it's impossible. One day she was merely a scrawny suburban shrew enjoying the simple pleasures of humiliating her anemic husband in the garden, and then, all of a sudden, without giving anyone a chance to lodge an objection with the council, she was pregnant. The fetus gestated for about an hour and a half, and then they were three, a cacophony of three, first thing on a Sunday morning, with matching washstand, recently varnished, ideal for indoor plants that are hard of hearing. Would you like a cup of tea? I'm avoiding her. They must be crazy to be up at this time making a noise like this, she said. They're just selfish. The really crazy ones are on the other side. He sells insurance and she sells cosmetics. If she can't restore your skin's natural smoothness in 6 days, he has a policy that will refund 50% of the retail price. Of course, this is only available to approved customers, and I think they know that I don't approve at all. She nestles just below my shoulder. She thinks my attempt to amuse her is a compliment, when actually it is the byproduct of other things. I think you're the craziest one in the street, she says, snuggling beside me. But she doesn't know you. Anyway, you're not in this street anymore. It's not true to say I didn't sleep at all. I must have, no matter what contrary arguments are put by the throbbing in my head. My eyes would have moved rapidly, perhaps in time with my new friend's breathing, because I dreamed that stupid dream again, the one that particularly embarrasses me. It must be based on something that happened, or else on a composite of many things, because its form doesn't vary. You would chide me if I told you about it, even if you were not somewhere else now. How can I put it? I have come home from somewhere. It is cold outside, but you are waiting for me in this bed. It's dark. I have this dream too often, I know that. Joseph Brodsky put it best, as though the dream was his. For darkness restores what light cannot repair. There, we are married, blessed. We make once more the two-backed beast, and children are the fair excuse of what we're naked for. There, I said it, albeit in someone else's words. Are you flattered? Is it pathetic, or just out of the question for us now? Many times I have dreamed of having children with you. Not just sleeping with you, although, of course, I think about that too. My new friend has drifted off to sleep again, this time in my arms. I can't really move without disturbing her. That's how it seemed since we got into bed all those hours ago. There is some kind of code or etiquette for sleeping with someone for the first time, but it is constantly changing, and I never knew it in the first place. Do you keep any clothes on, even if only for a little while? Can the temperature of the room be taken into account? If you disrobe too quickly, does it look presumptuous or crassly eager? You have to feign at least a little surprise at being in this position with someone when you've never known them this way before. On the other hand, you have to behave as if you're under the influence of the other person's body, with an insatiable hunger to know their soft and hidden parts, as though this person was the apotheosis of everyone you had ever lusted after. Our clothes are scattered on the floor. We could not have done it more randomly. Once the pretense that we might not sleep together had evaporated, everything else followed with the grace of a runaway train. If she brought her own condoms, I was too much of a gentleman to let her offer them. But when I reached for my own, it suddenly occurred to me that the ease and system of it might appear a little slick and too practiced. I didn't want to insult her gratuitously, so I kissed her as though she meant everything to me that I had wanted you to always mean to me, only without the need to protect myself. And she kissed me back in gratitude, as though I was going to rid her of all the pain she'd ever known and would tell me about when this was over. Although She was lovely and welcoming, her hair spilling out all over the pillow. I wished she wasn't here. Consumed by her moist gratitude and what must have been an exaggerated passion, it was as though she'd come straight from a dentist's waiting room, having just read 20 Ways to Please Your Man. I felt under the same obligation not to climax as I will feel to drive her home at the end. She has decided to give older men a try, and as old as she makes me feel, on behalf of all the older men who won't sleep with her but who will merely follow her step as she passes by, I must show her the utmost courtesy. This is the attribute used to market us. It's how older men get a look in. The curtains are completely drawn, just as you like them to be, so that we could trap the night way past midday, getting up only to have a pee, make a cup of tea, or put on the Django Reinhardt you'd bought for me. You told me one Sunday, when we were running late for one of those daunting lunches at your mother's, to act embarrassed when we arrived late, in a way that would give your family the impression our lateness was a consequence of our carnal appetites. You said it would stop them asking why we were so late, and at the same time give your mother some small pleasure at the promise of more grandchildren. Your mother liked me, especially next to your sister's husbands. But how does one suggest obliquely to someone's mother that fucking is the fair excuse of what her roast has burned for? Anyway, it would have been a lie. We'd been fighting. Do you remember? Not about your smoking. And when I had finally chosen a shirt, you were still on your knees by the dresser looking for the antidepressants. I'm trying to remember your cruel irrationality and that coldness you smuggled out of boarding school, hidden like everything else under your tunic, hidden so well I thought you were me. I thought it you at home, watching television with you, by yourself, with a plate of something colourful on your lap, unable to work the video recorder. And it has made me angry. It didn't have to be like this. I've wondered what would really happen if I visited you. You're so much better at this than me, I had thought. I hadn't known why at first, so stupidly, I had envied you in this regard. At 4 o'clock on other mornings, I've thought of you asleep in your house, the house I knew so well. I liked it more than you did, and talked you out of selling it. I'm cold, but if I reach for a t-shirt, my new friend will wake up. She's breathing through her mouth again. When she wakes up, she will tell me about her past boyfriends. The early ones, the exotic ones, the ones who hurt her most. She will be lonely when she wakes up. I'm sad for her. She deserves to have someone. I'm stroking her hair very gently. I'm sad for us too. I wonder if I'm lonelier now than I was at the end. Are you lonely? Perhaps you don't have time. There's a crack in the curtains and the light is getting in. Of course, one day I will come around and see you. You said that no one else ever made you so angry. But you were flattering me, and I didn't believe you. I don't feel it diminishes anything to admit that other people have made me cry. But I'll concede that admissions are hard. They are hard until you have to admit that the thing stares you in the face, until it's all around you like the weather. It's you now. Just you. Whatever is going on in my chest has woken her. My new friend looks up at me and sees you in my face. She doesn't ask any questions. She doesn't ask why you have made my eyes glisten in the light that comes through the gap in the curtains. Good morning, she says. She asks just this when I don't have enough love for the three of us. Good morning, again. Thanks. I read a very short extract from Seven Types of Ambiguity. This narrator is an entirely different kind of man. He's the kind of man that most women spend a lot of their time pretending they are not married to, or not attached to, or not attracted to. And most men spend a lot of time pretending that they can't begin to see anything of themselves in a man like this. And like most of us these days, he's a stockbroker. So this is from Seven Types of Ambiguity. Do I want a coffee? I want a coffee or a juice. I wish someone would tell me. There's a place on Chapel Street with incredible waitresses. One of the guys at work was talking about it. What was it called? I'm too old for the music they play here. Christ, it's not even music, but once you're here, you can't ask them to turn it down. You're lucky if they serve you after that. You're paying for it, for everything. I pick up a paper. Usually the best parts are missing. What are the best parts? Maybe I should eat something. I wish someone would tell me. Can I help you, sir? The waitress asks. I don't know if this is the place they were talking about at work, but if it isn't, I might start talking about it. She can't be any more than 15. Already so nasty. Even if she offers to help me. Every year they bring out a new model. I'm depreciating. Done too many miles. It's unfair. Yeah, she could help me. What juice seems to hit the spot today? I ask her with a smile. I hear myself ask that question. It doesn't actually make sense. It doesn't mean anything except that I've already begun rehearsing. I've begun rehearsing for a role as one of those middle-aged assholes who saunter into trendy coffee shops and cafes alone on weekends, wearing veined brown leather jackets with a recalcitrant newspaper tucked under one arm and ostentatious car keys tossed and caught in the other hand, calling too loudly to a girl, "What juice seems to hit the spot today?" Which doesn't actually mean anything. Doesn't mean anything except that I'm a god-awful lonely prick whose very being, or way of being, has ultimately put off anybody I've ever gotten close to, leaving me with a nice new smart-ass haircut and the weekend paper, all alone to talk too loudly in a cafe, reeking of aftershave and divorce. Does she think that I don't know that, this little double-breasted midriff with a serving pad, swishing her ponytail around like I'm some kind of pony's tail? Does she think that I can't see what's ahead of me? She makes no suggestions. She reels off the juice list from the blackboard menu on the wall. I could have done that. Doesn't she want a tip? Doesn't she know how it's meant to go? And she'll wonder why I pay for it. She'll feign outrage to hear I pay for it. I have to pay for it. Oh, excuse me, could you put some ginger and lemongrass in with that? Damn right, it's not a problem. She's gone. She's away clearing another man's table. He's about her age, or certainly closer to it than I am. Closer to it than I ever was. He's unshaven. I find him ugly. She doesn't. Actually, he repulses me. But not her. What does he drive? What does he make? What can a man so young possibly make that he can sit here and get at a smile like that, sit here without a trace of panic? He'll have to pay for it one day. Sure as hell, I can't hear what they're saying. I can't understand what they're saying. She can tell that I pay for it. What can she tell? I have a son. Please don't clear the table so fast. I have a son. I have a son who was taken as part of the most bizarre conspiracy imaginable. A conspiracy between my wife an old boyfriend of hers and a prostitute that I have been seeing, to be honest, for quite some time, longer than I care to remember. So don't tell me you'll be with me in a minute and then laugh like that with that man over there when, plainly, I need you now. Thank you. I don't know if anyone has any questions or not, but you're welcome to ask any if you have them. And if you don't, we can all go and have a drink, which is a very Australian way of ending anything, and actually quite an Australian way of beginning something, and also marking the middle of it. There is a question. Who was the main character in Seven Types of Ambiguity? Well, this is not meant to sound evasive or smartass or coy or anything, but, you know, to a large extent, it's in the eye of the reader, because all the characters keep coming in and out into each other's versions of the next installment of the story. I mean, I can confess which characters are the ones that have the moral or intellectual or aesthetic taste that I have, and that's to a large extent Simon, although I hope not to the extent that he has it, where it can be quite destructive and hurtful. And I wanted to make a point, because I often get criticised, particularly in Australia, for being kind of a bleeding heart liberal, that, you know, Simon is very definitely a liberal, and nonetheless in taking things to certain extremes, he hurts a lot of people. So I'd like to feel I'm an equal opportunity slanderer. And also, perhaps even more particularly from a sort of moral and intellectual standpoint, maybe Alex Klima, the psychiatrist. But in terms of the plot, it's kind of up to the reader. Some people think it's Anna's story, some people think it's Simon's story, some people think it's Alex Klima's story, and certainly I had a lot of fun with Joe, so he's got a good claim on the story. I don't know if that answers the question, or if I just wriggled out of it, you know, neatly, or maybe not so neatly. Any other questions? Did I decide to write from multiple points of view right off the bat? I did, actually. Yeah. I wrote the first part one of Seven Types of Ambiguity, 11 years before I finished it, because I panicked. I wrote it and I had mapped out or envisaged the, for want of a better term, the architecture of the book, and it scared the hell out of me because I hadn't yet written a novel yet, and I thought, I have two choices. I can either, or three, I guess. I can either, I have to remember what the three choices were. I can either write this all in one go now, immediately, and not pull it off, because I wasn't sure I had the stamina as a writer to do it. Still not sure I had the stamina as a writer to do it. Or I can put it away for a while. That's only two choices. There was a third, but I can't remember what it is. I can put it away for a while and come back to it when I've kind of, again, to continue the vaguely athletic analogy, when I developed greater fitness as a writer, and I wrote $3, my first novel, by definition. I wrote it first, and then eventually came back to it and finished it. Any other questions? Did I begin writing while I was still practicing law, and why did I decide to write instead of practicing law? Is that it? Well, actually, I started writing before I was even a law student. It's a funny question to try to answer accurately, because in many respects, I was always writing, even as a kid. I mean, I'm not suggesting I was writing well, but stories were really important to me, and in one way or another, trying to express myself, you know, often awkwardly and embarrassingly poorly, but you know, when I was at school, I wrote plays, and I used to play in a band. I was a failed musician. In fact, my father said people should pay me not to sing. And but I was the songwriter in the band as well, and we played when I was at university. And so, and I was writing short stories already when I was doing my first degree. You know, sort of the equivalent of of being at college before going to grad school. And so I was actually writing for longer than I was a law student and or a lawyer or anything to do with law, except somebody that thought they might want to study it and practice it. And then I had a position as an associate to a Supreme Court judge in Victoria, which is I guess the equivalent US term is clerking. I was clerking for a judge, and that was nowhere near as demanding as being in private practice. And it was during that time that I started to write $3. And I wrote some of the short stories. I wrote some short stories, some of which survived the cull and made it into The Reasons I Won't Be Coming. And then I wrote, while being a barrister to a certain extent, I should explain the difference that Commonwealth countries makes between the distinction in Commonwealth countries between being a barrister and a solicitor, put very simply or crudely, because I've been asked a lot this difference. A barrister is essentially a lawyer that specialises in court practice, in going to court and preparing documents and witnesses for trial and for court hearings. And a solicitor is the lawyer that you see from off the street, usually in an office. I mean, it's slightly more complicated and blurred than that, but essentially I was a... so I went from being a law student to an intern, so to speak, what we call an article clerk, then a solicitor, then an associate, i.e. a clerk, clerking for a judge, and then being a barrister. And all throughout this time, at different times, depending on how much time I had available away from law, I would write more or less. And technically, I still am a barrister. And, you know, I'm so pathetically financially insecure that I haven't yet been able to give it up. And even though I spent most of the last 3 years living in New York, I'm still paying rent on an office in Melbourne. and I go and visit... We have a clerk who's like a booking agent for barristers, and I go and visit him, and you know, he's very kind. He doesn't ask me when I'm coming back, when I'm practicing. But the beauty of it is, the reason I go into this great detail about it is that in Commonwealth countries, you're not permitted to be an employee or a partner or to employ anyone as a barrister, which means I'm self-employed and I have to be self-employed. And that's relevant to my writing because it means I can't be fired. You know, my clerk sort of looks at me in astonishment, can't believe I'm still doing this thing, this writing thing, and that I, you know, you seem to be living in New York. And I said, well, kind of, you know. but yeah, I mean, you know, I've been fairly fortunate, I admit, with my writing thus far. But still, you know, for someone with who wants to be, I suppose, a literary novelist, as opposed to a commercially successful one, you know, it's a very precarious life, and you can have, you know, fairly decent critical success and people would be astonished to know how little you're earning. So for this reason, I guess, and also because my family's in Australia and I have a lot of ties to Australia, I haven't quite been able to relinquish law, which is a long way of saying, slightly correcting an assumption in your question, that I'm no longer a barrister. I still am, although probably people in Melbourne in the legal fraternity would laugh at that. But did that answer your question, or just wrap it on, not quite answering it? His question was, is there a God? Another question. The question was, is there a sense of place in my stories? Am I writing with an Australian voice or with my own voice? Well, I'm definitely writing with my own voice, although it's my own voice infused in different characters, because frequently in some of the early short stories in the collection, I mean early in the sense that they come early in the book, and also In fact, in probably most of them, when I think about it, and certainly in Seven Types of Ambiguity, I assume the persona of the character I'm trying to tell the story through. But that's my version of that character. Is it peculiarly Australian? You've touched on a sensitive issue, not so much for me, but in Australia to a certain extent. Sometimes I've been criticised in Australia for, well, it's not directly criticised, but my sense is that some criticism is coming because I seem to be writing outside of what is considered to be an Australian tradition, and probably, you know, American readers wouldn't be aware that there even is an Australian literary tradition, and it's a relatively recent one historically compared to much of the rest of the world, but there is an Australian historical tradition, and to a large extent, and I'm really simplifying here, but it is to do with a search for identity. And I think that's because Australia is a young country with a small population, and in a sense, the writers have taken it upon themselves, and not just the writers, I think sort of artists generally in Australia have taken it upon themselves to try to define or determine what the hell it means to be Australian. I mean, you speak English like the English and like Americans, but you're neither English nor American. You're at the bottom of the world. You live on this continent, which is about the same size as the continental US, but there's nobody in it. There's a funny kind of love-hate relationship with Britain, and even to a certain extent with the US, but maybe more love than hate. But with Britain, perhaps it's the reverse. These are all valid questions, and they're interesting. But to be honest, I don't really write about that at all, and it's not a cynical attempt on my part to be of interest to American or British or European readers. But I think, to a large extent, and I'm sort of being self-analytical as I stand here, but because I haven't really thought about it, but I think it's because of the books I was reading when I was growing up, the books that were important to me. And it included a lot of American literature and a lot of British literature and European literature. And also, to some extent, it must be influenced by the fact that I'm Jewish. I'm very strongly ethnically Jewish. I'm not religious. I don't practice. But I was brought up knowing what it is, what the religion is. And in a funny way, and there are many Australians for whom this applies, I think, although hardly any of them are Jewish, but to an extent it taps me into Europe, and it taps me into, I guess, particularly New York. But even then, I don't want to be professionally Jewish as a writer in the same way as I don't want to be professionally Australian as a writer. I think, to a certain extent, it's simply that I don't want to be boxed in at all. So if I, you know, I'd like to be free to write anything I want and not have to deal with issues of, you know, what does it mean to be Australian and dealing with the bush and the outback and certain things that keep coming up in Australian literature, and often in a wonderful way. I'm not damning it, but it's come up so often it's almost stereotypical. And it bothers me as an Australian that, you know, when people from outside Australia think of Australia, it's usually in stereotypes. I remember very early in my publishing career, I rather stupidly agreed to go to some publisher's convention. There was hardly any other writers there, but I took advice from a former agent and went and had an appointment with a French editor, an editor at a French publishing house, not my current French publisher, I stress. He told me that the French were very interested in Australia, and there was now a separate category in French bookstores for Australian writing. And I thought, this is good news, this is terrific. And he said, oh yes, we love to hear about the kangaroos and the surfing and the desert and the outback and the bush. And I said, oh, so there's a great interest in stereotypes. And I don't really write about that at all. And, you know, there's a huge misconception about Australia, and even Australians to a certain extent perpetuate it, which is that, you know, there's that everybody's Paul Hogan, everybody's Anglo-Celtic, and everybody could, if pushed, slaughter a crocodile and eat it, you know. But in fact, most Australians live in the city, and 40% of the small population of about 20 million live in either Melbourne or Sydney. So, you know, we ain't that rugged. So I write, Seven Types of Ambiguity is firmly set in Melbourne, but many American readers have told me they forget that, because it could be any American city, and I would say any West... Yeah, sorry, I could answer that much sooner. The lady said, that's what I was getting at. I'm sorry. Any other questions, or have I kind of educated you out of asking them? Well, the gentleman asked, would it be easier to have commercial success if I wrote about criminal cases? I should stress, I haven't been that unsuccessful. I mean, I have had some commercial success. And actually, Seven Types of Ambiguity does deal with a criminal case very, very significantly, both in court and in the prison system. So we have to start telling people, you know... tell them it's a criminal book, you know, a crime novel, yeah. I think I know what you're getting at. You know, would I be able to write a John Grisham type of book? And I don't think I would. And that's no disrespect to him. I mean, there's a real sort of talent to getting that formula right, and I'm not sure I have that talent. Another question? Do I have any advice for writing from multiple points of view? Look, I start with the assumption, and it's possibly a flawed one, or maybe not a helpful one, but I'm telling the truth. I start with the assumption that there's actually more that we have in common with each other than that separates us. By which I mean, if I'm writing about a young woman, I think most of her is a bit like me, or like me sometimes, or me when I was younger, or me on a given day, and then there'll be other things that are totally different to me. But it's a healthy starting point, because then you're not so afraid of trying to inhabit that character. You think, well, you know, listen, when she's hungry like I'm hungry, and you know, when she's sleepy, likewise. And then there are certain things you often see with male writers. They want to make a point that they really understand women, and so you're going to read about menstruation whether you like it or not. There's going to be some childbirth, and there's going to be some uncomfortable things there that men don't normally get to experience. And I don't think I've fallen into that trap yet, but there's time, if I'm good enough. I don't know if that answers the question, but it doesn't. Okay, that's good. Oh, I'm sorry. When do I make a decision on? I guess you mean particularly with Seven Types of Ambiguity, because the short stories, you know, I've adopted a persona and that's the way it's going to stay throughout the whole persona. With the exception of short story Manslaughter and The Reasons I Won't Be Coming shifts perspectives to a large extent. Well, I can only answer with respect to Seven Types of Ambiguity, really, because that's probably the only time. $3 was written all through the same voice. With Seven Types of Ambiguity, I knew I wanted to get this character from, you know, point A to point B, and then the next character from point B to point C, and so on. So I knew, in a sense, at a certain plot point, it was going to change. But then the difficulty was, firstly, choosing the plot point, and secondly, finding a way into that character. And sometimes it was harder than other times. I'm going to pretend that I think that answered your question. Probably didn't, but, you know, we'll fake it. Are there any other questions? And don't feel that there need to be. It doesn't look like there are. Well, thank you very much for coming. I've really enjoyed myself. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for Joseph Ellis, Linda Fairstein, Dave Barry, Julian Barnes, Jill Connor Brown, John Hodgman, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on January 12th, 2006.